Welcome to the Arlington Street Church podcast. Founded in 1729, Arlington Street continues today as a gathering place for progressive people of faith in the greater Boston area and beyond. We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.
We need that reminder, don't we? To put our roots down, to feel our connection to the earth, the sound of the water across the stones, the blood across our bones. In this time of spinning uncertainty, of fear and meanness in the world, we need it. We also need the reminder that we are not the first people to have faced the challenge of living in times that do not seem conducive to thriving. The psalmist, or one of the psalmists, in the very first psalm, likely written well over 2,000 years ago, tells us, "Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields fruit in its season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers." You may know of Howard Thurman, the mystic, preacher, theologian, and mentor to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He served right here at Boston University's Marsh Chapel as dean late in his career. Thurman grew up in the Jim Crow South in Daytona, Florida. All around him in his childhood was the very real fear of violence, the fact of segregation, and the looming presence of the Ku Klux Klan. Raised by a grandmother who told him stories of the dignity and honor of his people, while also describing her life as an enslaved person, Thurman knew the very precarious rights that belonged to him as a black child in the early 20th century in America. In his autobiography, Thurman describes finding relief in private moments in the natural world. On the beach at Daytona, which was filled with crowds and car races during the day, he found at night, alone, a special benediction. He writes, "The ocean and the night together surrounded my little life with a reassurance that could not be affronted by the behavior of human beings. The ocean at night gave me a sense of timelessness, of existing beyond the reach of the ebb and flow of circumstances. I was made keenly aware when a storm came sweeping seemingly from the depths of the sea. First, there was a steady quieting, a lull during which the waves seemed to lack the strength to even wash up fully on the shore. The seagrass along the top of the dunes was still. No wind blew in the treacherous quiet. Then a stirring like a gentle moan broke the surface. Suddenly, the winds were ferocious, and the waves, now 10 feet high, dashed into the shore. Again, the boundaries of self did not hold me. Unafraid, I was held by the storm's embrace. The experience of these storms gave me a certain overriding immunity against much of the pain with which I would have to deal in the years ahead, when the ocean became only a memory. The sense I held. I felt rooted in life, in nature, in existence." He goes on to tell the story of a very special relationship with a tree. "When the storms blew, the branches of a large oak tree in our backyard would snap and fall, but the topmost branches of that oak tree would sway, giving way just enough to save themselves from snapping loose. I needed the strength of that tree, and like it, I wanted to hold my ground. Eventually, I discovered that the oak tree and I had a unique relationship. I could sit my back against its trunk and feel the same peace that would come to me in my bed at night. I could reach down in the quiet places of my spirit, take out my bruises and my joys, unfold them, and talk about them. I could talk aloud to the oak tree and know that I was understood. It too was part of my reality, like the woods, the night, and the pounding surf, my earliest companions, giving me space. It was many more decades beyond that boyhood experience of the ocean and the night and the oak tree before Thurman would achieve the recognition and influence that has me quoting his autobiography to you this morning. And yet, that sense of communion with a natural world in which he was understood and accepted exactly as he was, to which he belonged completely, bolstered him and rooted him through the many hardships to come. Deep in our bones, we know, don't we, that we belong to the seasons and cycles of nature, that we humans have a lot to learn from the other life forms on the planet and how they grow and thrive. Robin Wall Kimmerer, a member of the Potawatomi Nation and a biologist, writes beautifully about the interdependence and cooperation that are hallmarks of thriving ecosystems. Kimmerer is one of the many biologists over the last half century who have upset the centuries of scientific belief that the natural world was based on competition, with observing and proving that the key principle of survival is cooperation. In her essay, The Service Berry, Kimmerer traces the cycle of one small berry known by many names. She begins her essay, "The cool breath of evening slips off the wooded hills, displacing the heat of the day, and with it come the birds, as eager for evening as I am. They arrive in a flock of calls that sound like laughter, and I have to laugh back with the same delight. I've never felt such a kinship with my namesake, Robin, as in this moment when we are both stuffing our mouths with berries and chortling with happiness. The bushes are laden with fat clusters of red, blue, and wine purple in every stage of ripeness. So many you can pick them by the handful. I'm glad I have a pail, and it's getting pretty heavy. The birds carry their bellies in the buckets of berries in the buckets of their bellies and wonder if they will be able to fly with so much cargo. This abundance of berries feels like a pure gift from the land. I have not earned, paid for, or labored for them. There is no mathematics of worthiness that reckons I deserve them in any way. And yet here they are, along with the sun and the air and the birds and the rain. You could call them natural resources or ecosystem services, but the robins and I know them as gifts. We both sing gratitude with our mouths full." A practice of gratitude like that, not a polite thank you that we offer reflexively, but a way of feeling in your bones the very blessing of being nurtured by what you did not create, is well known, especially by Indigenous people. And the gratitude is most visible when it's expressed by recognizing a gift has been received and then keeping the gift flowing. Not an exchange with the same person or being from which we received it, but keeping gifts moving in the world, offering what we can when we can. In the early 1970s, linguist Daniel Everett was living among the Piranha people of the Amazon basin in Brazil, studying their language. What he got was a lesson in a very different way of being in the world, focused on the present, doing what one's best in each moment, present to all that was around them. In a recent interview, Everett says of the Piranha, If you earn their trust and sit with them, someone will always be touching you, smiling at you, sitting with you and asking you questions and showing you their love for their children. Because that's what they're focused on. They're not going to show you how much fish they've accumulated, and they don't kill a lot of animals so they could preserve a lot of meat. When I asked them why they don't smoke or salt meat to preserve it for the future, one piraha said to me, "I store my meat in the belly of my brother. When I give him food, he will give me food. That's how we preserve meat. We take care of each other." So much of what we learn in our Western industrialized culture is the opposite of that, isn't it? Only to give once our own needs and our family's needs are secured well into the future, to be suspicious of those who need money and ask for it, stock up our pantries in order to prepare for disaster. Our novels and movies and television shows about devastating events focus on the survival game, where everyone's clawing for their own safety, food, and water at any cost. Whether it's zombies or infected nearly dead people or another life form that has come to take over our planet, we're immersed in stories of our survival depending on our individual wits and skills and ruthlessness in protecting our own. But deep in our own hearts, when we put our roots down and feel our feet on the ground, we know better, don't we? Research actually shows that in the midst of disaster, the most prevalent human nature is resilient, resourceful, generous, empathetic, and brave. Rebecca Solnit, in her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, tells the stories of disasters starting from the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco all the way through Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And she notes the uplifting fact that in every case, the behavior of the people most affected by the calamity banded together, shared resources, cared for their neighbors, and offered each other comfort and hope. A soup kitchen springing up in Golden Gate Park after the 1906 earthquake, led by a woman who had only a few vegetables, but knew survival meant everyone sharing whatever they had. Folks evacuating the Twin Towers, stopping to pick up and carry wheelchair users down the stairs. Neighbors creating makeshift rafts to check in on other neighbors, bringing them to safety in the midst of the flooding during Katrina. None of them waited for authorities from afar to take action at the scene. And they describe a kind of solidarity and even joy in coming together to do what was necessary to keep each other safe. Solnit points out that the word emergency comes from emerge, to rise out of. An emergency is a separation from the familiar, a sudden emergence into a new atmosphere, one that often demands we ourselves rise to the occasion. Catastrophe comes from the Greek kata, or down, and strafen, or turning over. It means an upset of what is expected, to emerge into the unexpected. And it's not always terrible, though these words have come to imply ill fortune. Disaster reveals what else the world could be like, reveals the strength of that hope, that generosity, that solidarity. It reveals mutual aid as a default operating principle, and civil society as something that's always waiting in the wings when it's absent from the stage. We could use some of that upset right now, couldn't we? Because we're feeling a kind of upset that leaves us feeling powerless. Solnit also notes that the folks who are farther from the epicenter of a disaster are often more frightened. Because what we imagine as overwhelming or terrifying when we're safe becomes something we actually can cope with when we must, when there's no time for fear. In this time, when so many of us are searching, wondering how to stem the tide of the terrifying persecution of people based on their gender identity, their race, immigration status, their poverty, the escalation of climate threat, I think we would do well to heed the lessons we know deep in our bones, told in the story of a black boy in Florida in 1909, the ancient practices of indigenous people the world over, the consistent practices of humans in the face of disaster. We can let ourselves be governed by a sense of gratitude for each gift we have, to share all that's needed to keep our communities healthy and strong and thriving, to offer all that we can to the shared project of our flourishing. Robin Wall Kimmerer again writes, "The most important thing each of us can know is our unique gift and how to use it in the world. Individuality is cherished and nurtured because in order for the whole to flourish, each of us has to be strong in who we are and carry our gifts with conviction so that they can be shared with others." We have so many gifts right here, my friends. Gifts of financial resources, of hands-on skills, of imagination, of sleeves rolled up to help, gifts of compassion and care. We can find our community transformed by the movement of our gifts if we can dig deep and find what is needed within and among us to meet this moment. If we stay present to what that moment asks of us, connected to our fellow beings and rooted both in this physical ground and in the grounding of our faith, we can offer a sort of revolution from below, a flourishing in love in practice that can thrive like the lotus in the muddy ground of this world. May it be so. Amen. Robin Wall Kimmerer says, "Weep, weep," calls a toad from the water's edge, and I do. If grief can be a doorway to love, then let us all weep for the world we are breaking apart so that we can love it back to wholeness again. My friends, let us celebrate the extraordinary gifts among us moving as compassionate action in our world, moving us toward wholeness once again. May love hold us until we meet again. The service begins when the service ends. Amen.
Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.